In September 1962, on a moonless night over the Atlantic Ocean, 1,000 miles from any land, the engines of Flying Tiger Flight 923, headed to Germany, failed one by one. The pilot, John Murray, didn't have long before the plane was going to ditch headlong into the Atlantic Ocean and into 20-foot waves. The story has been hidden for quite a while, but there's a new book about it called Tiger in the Sea, and its author, Eric Lindner, joins us now. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
All right. This call was fraught from the beginning, wasn't it? We had a delay of about half a minute when I first spoke to you. Hopefully, it will keep going. Welcome to the show, Eric. I know it's stupid o'clock where you are right now. What time actually is it?
It's 1:32 in the morning, the California morning.
Wow, what a brave man you are for staying up for us. We appreciate it. So listen, this is an incredible story. I mean, I'm an aviation enthusiast. I have a pilot's license. I must confess, it's a story I've never even come across. Why has it been such a hidden story?
Well, that's a great, great question. And thank you again for having me on. I think it's for two main reasons. First of all, the files, I've estimated 10,000 pages, were stolen from the official U.S. government files, were stolen from the National Archives right outside Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And secondly, it happened just before the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay.
And the plane that went down was a Lockheed plane, and the Cuban Missile Crisis photos were being snapped by Lockheed planes, U-2s, and no one is really sure, but there was, they call it murky Cold War politics. That's what I've heard.
How extraordinary. It was on its way from New Jersey to Frankfurt. Its call sign was Flying Tiger. Was that a commercial airline?
It was a commercial airline. However, it was founded by a fighter squadron formed in China, actually, as an auxiliary of the Chinese Air Force against Imperial Japan in 1941. But it began as it was the first around the world cargo airline, but it flew also for the CIA. It flew humanitarian missions, and until it was acquired by Fred Smith and FedEx in 1989.
Interesting. So the aircraft itself, we're talking here of 1962, the kind of heyday, really, of commercial aviation, if you're a kind of, you know, like me, who likes to dream of those kind of aircraft journeys. What aircraft are you talking about here, and how was it as an aircraft to be on board as a passenger?
Well, it was a Lockheed called the Super Constellation. It was designed in 1937 by four engines, huge engines. At the time, it was absolutely the peak. When it was in the 30s and 40s, it was the peak of piston prop designed by Howard Hughes. But at the time, 1962, jets were just coming on board. They were just beginning to take hold. The first Boeing 707s. In the late 50s. But to be on board that plane at that time could be a bit, could produce a bit of anxiety, especially on that flight it did, because the engines would rattle, they'd spit, they'd fire. And often, or at least it wasn't unusual, for at least one of the four engines on these big planes to go down. But three of them to go down over the middle of the North Atlantic was, they called, a 1 in 10 million.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, nowadays, if a four-engine aircraft had three engines go down, like a Boeing 747, for example, you could actually land it with one. But back in those days, I guess one just wasn't enough.
One just wasn't enough. It was like a sack of rocks on a pelican trying to land or something, yeah.
Amazing. And, of course, it's the worst thing in the world for a pilot. I've experienced it myself. When the thing in front of you, keeping you in the air, or in their case, behind them, just suddenly stops, it's a terrifying moment. Yep. But for three to go, my goodness.
Yep. Yeah. It was unimaginable. It's hard for me to imagine. I tried to just really be a scribe and emissary of the survivors, the crew and the passengers who survived, to tell their story. Yeah.
Absolutely. Amazing. Incredible. And ordinarily, of course, as a pilot, you're trained to force land an aircraft after an engine failure, but you've normally over land, over sea, whole other world of pain there. I mean, you're trained in a way to do it, but you've never done it for real. And you really are at the mercy of the elements, because you've no idea what you're going to meet when you get down there.
Absolutely. Beautifully put. That's exactly correct. Right.
So the pilot, John Murray, he didn't have long to make this decision. We think nowadays, of course, of plane landing on water. We think of Sully Sullenberger in the Hudson River landing his Airbus. That was a little different. You had a bit of time there. He had a very adaptable aircraft. He had electronics. He had people who knew what they were doing all around him. This guy must have been absolutely terrified, John Murray, but his instincts would kick in and his training would kick in. Of course, we're taught as pilots various different things. Some airlines have different techniques in terms of where you would land on the sea. Some are told to land in parallel with the waves. I think that wasn't what he decided, right?
That's correct. No, the standard, the explicit instructions in the operating manual, all the manuals, all RAF, Coast Guard around the world basically said you land parallel with the waves. You do not land against them, but he was a trained engineer. He grew up around flying boat captains. He was rated on 7 different aircraft, including amphibian and seaplanes, and he said the only way he could slow the plane down so that it didn't destroy an impact, the only possible way was to fly into the teeth of the wind, 65 mile an hour winds. This is almost hurricane, and it slowed it down, still hit the waves, 20 foot waves at 120 miles an hour.
But it
would have hit it. Who knows how fast it would have hit it, and the plane could have crumpled. It made the difference in the world.
Wow. Yep. So, yep. And of course, for a passenger on board this aircraft, he would have made an announcement that they're going to ditch, the one that we all dread. You know, when we get the safety announcement at the beginning, we think, well, that's never going to happen. They tell us all about the life jackets and the life rafts, but it's never going to happen. Let's just read my newspaper. But, there they were faced with that very thing. They must have been absolutely terrified.
Well, they were terrified. What I've heard, what I've read, I've actually been able to piece together from hidden private archives. There was obviously terror throughout the plane. Murray was cool. They said he was cool, absolutely cool. He'd been in several crashes before. He'd lost engines before. He'd had his plane shot up by Egyptian anti-aircraft flying over the Red Sea. So he'd begun flying as a teenager. So he was a very cool customer. There was terror throughout the plane, and the flames were going, the engines were stopping and shuddering the plane. It was unimaginable, almost unimaginable.
And of course, the ideal thing in that situation, and again, it's what's in pilot's training, is if you're going to ditch an aircraft, you ditch it near a vessel of some description so they can come and rescue you. But he had no vessels anywhere near him, did he?
He had no vessels. Captain Sullenberger did an unbelievable job, no question about it. A real hero, but it was daylight. He was right near shore. There were rescue vessels nearby. Murray had nothing near him. He was when problem starting. He was about 900 miles from land. He put it down 580 miles from land. The nearest ship at the time was about 11 hours away. Oh. It was a grain freighter going the other way, a Swiss grain freighter.
Yeah. Oh my goodness me, that's extraordinary. Now, as he ditched the aircraft, the worst happened. A wing broke off. The left wing tore off. Unsurprisingly, the plane then broke basically in two. It was heading into mountainous waves, and quite a few people lost their lives. But an incredible amount survived. How did they survive? What was the procedure that happened there with life rafts and all the rest of it?
Well, a great question. Actually, I guess the most important point to make is that the plane got down. It didn't break. A wing did snap off, but everyone got off the plane alive, ambulatory. Murray made sure, like Captain Sullenberger did. He was the last person off the plane as his duty as a captain. He made sure everyone was off. So everyone got off the plane, which was absolutely stunning.
Wow.
Yeah, everyone got off the plane. 76 people. That's when the problems happened. They're supposed to have at least five rafts. They couldn't find any of the rafts in the middle of a pitch black night. Couldn't find any of them.
That's just the worst in the world, isn't it? So some people got off the aircraft and then basically just drowned due to a lack of life rafts.
That's exactly. Actually, they tried to get off. They were supposed to get off the wing. One of the wings had snapped off, so they couldn't. They piled out. They were looking for the rafts. Finally, they found a spare raft, one spare raft. It was unintentionally inflated upside down, and 51 people of 76 made it on board. The others, perished trying to make it there, couldn't make it there, couldn't find it. There were no lights. There were no flashlights. Well, pardon me. One flashlight was found, but it was pitch dark, And you're right, though. So 28 people perished, but a few of them perished later in the evening. But yeah, very true. All of them perished because poor life vests, poor life rafts, and just, you know, horrifically high seas, cold, 48 degree temperature, no one around, no ships, no planes. They couldn't see a plane. They didn't see a single plane. They could not see. It was too dark. It's just remarkable that anyone survived.
Extraordinary. And the life raft that was remaining was designed to carry around 25 people maximum. But as you said, there were 51 people in those waters, and they all got aboard that one raft.
Yeah. It's remarkable. Maximum 25. It was designed to hold 20, but it was designed to hold 20 up with potable water and flashlights and flares and all that survival stuff. It was unintentionally blown up semi-automatically upside down. And after everyone had piled in, it was too dangerous and too scary to jump out because it was 4-mile-an-hour current. It would have taken the raft away. So they were on an upside down raft for many of them for 7 hours at night.
Absolutely extraordinary. Now, the captain, Murray, was able to make SOS calls, and those SOS messages had been heard, in particular by a Swiss freighter called the Celerina. But I think it took about 6 hours. They drifted for 22 miles from the crash site, but somehow the Celerina found them.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable. Captain Murray, just before he was the last one off the plane, he said, "I have an inspiration." That's his words from flying in Egypt and Syria. And he went back into the cockpit. He was knocked out on impact. Head was split open. Lost his glasses. Blood covering his face. Couldn't see. Grabbed his flashlight from the cockpit. Made it out. And he couldn't see. Handed it to an Alabama Joe Hoffer Army. He pointed up in the sky. A guy who had flown from near your hometown, Prestwick, Captain Joe Lewis, checkout flight. He saw a beam, a single beam.
Wow.
And Air Ministry spokesman called it like looking for a speck of grease in a foam bath. Saw one light. The raft didn't see him. He pinged that light over across the sea. The Celerina caught it. And the Celerina made its way across the sea to the raft.
That's just an extraordinary story. And another bit of luck happened to them, that a Canadian aircraft carrier, the Bonaventure, was also monitoring the distress calls. And they managed to get close with their helicopters and ferried medical supplies to the Celerina and removed the most severely wounded.
That is correct. The heroes that night and the next day, RAF chopper pilots, Robert Law, Canadian chopper pilots, Royal Canadian Navy, they flew against, it was one of those things where they could not be commanded by the commanding officer to fly. It was so dangerous. And they flew the two helicopters, which I love the name. One of them was Fallen Angel. Oh. The other was Pedro.
Wow.
And they shuttled them back. And then they were called off. The commander said, "You can fly no more. It's too dangerous." So they only managed to get four off before the flying conditions were too severe. Gale force winds. Just lashing. So they only managed to get four off, and then the Celerina chugged with 44 towards Cork.
Absolutely extraordinary. Did the captain survive all of this?
He did survive, but I'll let the rest of the story play out. But he did manage to survive. Yes, this round of the story.
Right.
But he was in bad shape. I mean, many people were burned over. Chemical burns over 20% of their body from the aviation fuel, broken bones. He had a deep laceration on his head. Just amazing that anyone survived, including him. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. What a story. And it really does reek of a film script, doesn't it? I'm amazed this hasn't been turned into a film already.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Bill, I say, yeah, maybe. But we've been called a few times, but we're really focused on the book. I mean, really just trying to focus to get this story out. And actually, while the survivors are still alive, because a lot of people I've interviewed have passed since I started working on the book 6 years ago.
Absolutely. Wasn't there one who wrote a book about it? Mr. Caruso, Fred Caruso.
There was. He wrote a terrific book, Fred Caruso. He's helped me a lot. His wife, Ellen Caruso, from New York. He bought a cottage in Glengarriff, west of Cork.
Wow.
And he wrote a wonderful book. Yes, he did. and he has helped me a great deal. I'm in his debt. Fred Caruso. Hey, wow. Fred, out there, if you're listening.
Amazing. So the book that you've done is called Tiger in the Sea. Eric Lindner is our guest today on Let's Talk. Eric, an amazing story. People can get the book from our website, tre.radio, and find out what the kind of finality of all of this is and the stuff that you alluded to there about the captain. A pleasure to talk to you today. And, you know, if anything at all about this, it makes us realize that when they're giving those safety briefings, you know, they're there for a very good reason.
Oh, my gosh. What a wonderful way to close. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Yep. Pleasure to talk to you. You go and get yourself some sleep, Eric.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you so much.
You take care.
Have a great day.